Okay, let's come to order and do a roll call. Jen Hedrick.
Here.
Cody Darr.
Here.
Tony Grove.
Present.
Katrina Bowles.
Here.
Bill Whitekemper.
Here.
Kim Krause.
Here.
I am here, and John Conway is out of town tonight and next week.
Greg Coffin finally.
Oh, Greg Coffin. I'm sorry. That's right. Greg Coffin.
I already
took you off the list. We can't get back.
You're just the star on my list. That's all I was expecting.
I came back. I had
Okay, so we should approve tonight's agenda. But first, discussion of any changes, corrections, additions. If not, can I have a motion, please?
I move to approve the agenda.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Thank you. In favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Got two sets of minutes to finish approving. August 2nd. Thank you, Cody, for sending your changes. Does it look good?
Good enough.
Okay. Okay. Any other comments, additions, deletions, or corrections? Okay. We're good. Can I have a motion for approval?
I move to approve August 2nd minutes.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you. In favor?
Aye.
Aye. Good to go on that. And then, oh, did we not get the 9th? We just got the revised version of the 7th. We don't have the 9th. Okay, good. So we have one. Done. Okay, so on our agenda for this evening, we're going to start with Mr. Teddy's presentation on the, you are from Community Development, Director of Planning, right?
I'm Director of Community Development.
Director of Community Development. And he's going to talk to us tonight about the development process, the new development. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graber-Rice. I appreciate the invitation. And thank you all for your service. I know what you have is probably one of the more challenging tasks that council would give a committee. And I'll do my part, if I can, to maybe give you some things to think about. I didn't come with a solution to our infrastructure problems, though, so sorry to disappoint everybody.
You'd be popular.
That would have made this meeting
really cool. Yeah, I got the answer. Here, this is it. This is a fair way to do everything. But I do want to share kind of my perspective based on what I do in city government. For those of you, and I think most of you know what community development does, but for those of you that may not be fully aware of what we do, we're a department that does do planning. We receive all the zoning and annexation and subdivision requests, basically the development approval stuff that goes to the city council eventually. We handle that review process. We do all the building and construction permits and inspections. That's through our building and site development division, and we do transportation planning as part of the federally mandated process. So that's the CATSO staff. So we do transportation planning, and then we have the neighborhood services division that I like to think of as part of the caring of the community that we plan and build. In the sense that they do code enforcement inspections, they run the rental conservation program, which is the inspection of rental properties and issuance of certificates. We do the community development block grants and the home investment partnership grants, which are federal dollars that can be spent on public facilities, on affordable housing, and somewhat on infrastructure, at least for the block grant. So that's a little bit of what we do. I'm going to focus really on that sort of front-end stuff, which is the development approvals, because that's where we really interface with the infrastructure problem, and just offer you a few thoughts here. I'm going to focus on the development code project that we have in progress, to the extent that that touches on infrastructure questions, and then something called the infrastructure scorecard, which is an activity that was recommended in the comprehensive plan Columbia Imagined that we have started. we've paused somewhat because the development code is such an enormous demand on our time, but we'll resume at the end of the year and hopefully produce a system of rating sites according to some of their infrastructure capacities and potentials. But just for some introductory thoughts here, this is kind of a personal, professional perspective on how I think about cities. I mean, isn't it true that the things we build generally outlive those that build them? And we all inherit in our cities a legacy of what generations past have built to serve the community in a particular point in time. And cities go through this evolution where in the early going, I'm talking about 19th century, early 20th century here, there really isn't a very strong connection at all between land planning and infrastructure development. In fact, early town plans, or what are referred to as plans of towns, are often nothing more than surveys or plats of subdivision. There's exceptions. There's early plan communities we can point to where either it was a communitarian movement that had a ready-made community that wanted a special built environment, or maybe there were company towns where there was another motive for building a lot of infrastructure to serve the community. But generally, towns started as speculative ventures, and that's true of Columbia, that's true of the majority of our cities that are of Columbia's age. Example is the downtown, the original town plat. It surveyed that part of our city into lots and blocks and street rights of ways without any corresponding improvement of facilities as we think of them today. So there were these bets made that the university would come, and then once the university came, that it would succeed and it would add value to property and people would buy property, and somehow it would just all come together with infrastructure. And of course, that's part of the story. The other part of the story is we didn't have the kind of infrastructure technologies and structures we had. But this is part of the legacy that we deal with, because downtown, to use an example, has been retrofit with infrastructure, some cases many decades ago, and a lot of it's obsolete and has needed to be replaced or still needs to be replaced. We then entered another stage, what I'll just call the modern era, where cities evolved to the point where they realized that by creating separate units of real estate, you're creating a lot of individual demands that persons buying lots would have, and a lot of individual needs that had to be coordinated. So sooner or later, Columbia, like other cities, adopted subdivision regulations. And what subdivision regulations do is they coordinate the activity of land subdivision with land improvement. So as those of you who work in the business know, you don't create a street with lots on it without having also the obligation to provide paved streets, storm sewers, water main, and connections to sewer and the like. So we have succeeded in evolving to that level where now there is not that lag where we create lots and then somehow streets get built. And just not to dwell on the point, but my wife and I bought our first house. It was in Illinois. I looked at the legal description of the property, and it was an 1873 subdivision, but I looked around the subdivision, and all the houses were probably no older than the 1910s. Ours was built in the 1950s. And that's an example of what I'm talking about. It was a speculative addition to a town, and no one graded the streets. They entered a subdivision plat. No one graded the streets until many decades later, and that's what stimulated the house building activity. So thankfully, we're beyond that point now, and we are, I think, doing a good job of providing the services that our newly created units of real estate need. But along with that, you need continuity between these individual subdivisions, and that's what the capital budgeting process provides is the need for large-scale improvements, the arterial roads, the trunk sewers, the treatment plants, the parks, et cetera, something that knits it all together. Well, the way I see this is we continue to evolve. Resources for infrastructure become more scarce as growth occurs. The stakes increase. We're entering this next level and have been in this next level probably for a long time, where we have to think about leveraging our public investments, get the maximum bang for the buck, in other words, with the things that we choose to build in the way of public infrastructure. And we got to think about this fair allocation of infrastructure costs because, yeah, all the streets we're creating creates the maintenance needs down the line, as well as underground infrastructure does the same. And we have to not only look at the particular site and what the particular subdivision or development needs, but we have to look at these interrelationships. What does it mean in terms of the overall plan, whether it's a master plan for roads or the master plan for sewer? What system improvements have to be made to accommodate this growth and the impacts it will have? And then have we thought about the ongoing maintenance needs? You probably already know this. You may have already received separate briefings from other staff on some of these topics. So I apologize if it's old hat to you, but this again is just me reflecting on kind of some of the things we've done. These are some examples of things we've done that I think raise our game in the area of infrastructure development. 2007, Chapter 12A was amended to create on-site stormwater detention requirements, water quality requirements with the accompanying manual. We had new street standards in 2004. Here I'm referring to the cross-section of the streets, how the streets look from edge to edge. And this was groundbreaking because we thought of streets as complete systems that had to serve not only vehicles but also bikes and pedestrians. So it's a complete cross-section for different classifications of roadways, and that's known as Appendix A in our subdivision regulations. And like yourselves, that was a committee process, a stakeholder group that did that work, and I think very successfully in the end. Related but something a little different is the street, storm, sewer, and sanitary sewer specifications and standards. Public Works Department did a major revision of those standards in 2012. The point here is we're building infrastructure better to last longer than ever before. There's changes to the specifications for concrete of sidewalks, the pavement and base of streets, the materials used in sewers, and this kind of thing. So what it means is we're building our infrastructure better than before. We still have that legacy, though. Decades and decades of development built to different standards that we've got to deal with. Of course, there's been various rate increases and sales tax extensions that have helped in developing these sort of system improvements, the master plans for various utilities and the roadway system. One of the things I've singled out here is including the private common collector elimination program as part of a ballot issue. I see that as very significant. That was the city council's policy decision to say this shouldn't, these private sewers that are shared among several property owners need to be replaced, but they shouldn't be replaced at those property owners' expense. Of course, there's the time and disruption of the excavations and the construction and that kind of thing, and then there's the queuing it takes a lot of time to get those accomplished. But that's a major leap forward in our infrastructure development because it's looking back at a system that's no longer considered to be the appropriate way to develop sewer, and it's doing remedial activities and using rates to pay for it. Get About Columbia added a major windfall of capital for bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure, so a lot of what we see in the way of bike lanes bike paths and some sidewalks on major streets is thanks to that federal program. There was a revision of the 8-acre point sewer policy, revised it to 100-acre point in 2008. And John, I don't know that, or John and Tad, I don't know if we've been doing 100-acre point sewers anytime recently, but there's a policy on the books, and by increasing it from 80 to 100 acres, that lessened the general public burden. In other words, the city would not build as much of those trunk sewers as it had in the past by changing the standard from an 80-acre point watershed to 100-acre point. And then my own department, these activities I'm describing generally don't involve community development directly, but we've been doing building permit streamlining in the last several years. This is a smart growth principle. Try to make your process as predictable as possible. We've got an initial screen process where we don't start review till everything's complete. So we're not doing piecemeal reviews of major projects. And then we have the one-stop shop where we're the coordinator. So we're really the central point of contact for everybody, not just the developer customers, but the citizens that are curious about construction. And we collect the comments from other departments. Infrastructure development is traditionally described in city plans, and we have a general plan. Of course, we have a whole family of master plans I think you've probably heard about from other guest speakers. The comprehensive plan is the most general. It refers to those master plans. It establishes the general vision for the development of the community. Typically, plans have a physical element, and traditionally they map out all the existing major systems, and they also show where we're going with the components of those systems. So for roadways, for example, they include a map of major roadways, and then they'd indicate where road extensions or capacity improvements are desired. Same with utility corridors. Our plan doesn't, we reserve that to the individual master plans because of the complexity of our geography. It would be a major task to map out all the utility networks and then show major extension projects in the plan, but that's something that traditionally comprehensive plans do. There is a parks master plan. We've got a very good system for staying on top of park needs. There are standards for each level of parks, and I know this is not one of your core topics, but just to use this as an example, we've mapped out the areas where there is a documented need for parks, and so when we have a subdivision or development in that area, we engage the parks department with that developer, and there'll often be an acquisition or sometimes an acquisition donation of land to make sure that that neighborhood is going to be served with parkland near it or even in it. Fire stations, fire has a system where they rate areas according to response time, so they know kind of where those standard response times are because of the station locations, and then they know areas where there are some deficiencies, and they use that as a planning document to target sites for fire stations on those periods when a fire station is needed. And then plans can map greenways and open space assets that are apart from parks and then other kinds of public facilities as well. And then a plan is a policy plan. It recommends initiatives, programs, and policies. And our plan, in the back of it, the last chapter is implementation, and we have a number of initiatives that are recommended by the plan. The two that I'm talking about tonight are examples of that. There are, I think I ran off my slide here a little bit. The ones that relate directly to infrastructure in Imagine Columbia's future are a policy to promote fiscally sustainable growth. And one of the actions that's recommended is development of an infrastructure scorecard or a rating system. And then the urban service area is another example where the actions within an urban service area include some sufficiency of services, testing to evaluate development that is perhaps in the city limits or outside the city limits, but is in an area that we've either indicated is now committed to some city services such as sewer, or it's completely outside that area. And we use the plan as a tool to evaluate those things. Here's the infrastructure scorecard. As I said, the policy heading that this comes under is planning for fiscally sustainable growth. And how it's described in the plan is an action to objectively assess the appropriateness of new development based on short and long-term infrastructure costs and burdens on public infrastructure and services. You're probably familiar or have heard that the Boone County uses a scorecard system. They have eight different items that they look at, and they also have point values that they assign. One of them, for example, is how near or far is the site from a city? And I know they just look at a handful of cities. Columbia is definitely one of them. So proximity is one of their criteria. And that's because they're a county and they realize that a large development or a dense development is going to need city services. So they rate it higher the closer it is to a city, quite naturally. And they, I know there's at least reference to it in the plan development section of their code, where it's one of the several things that staff does when they process applications is they run it through that that scoring, and then they report the results out. I can't say, because our plan commission meets the same time as theirs does, Thursdays at 7 o'clock. I haven't seen them in action reporting this to their staff, but I've had a number of conversations with their staff over the years about how they use their scorecard. So there's been interest in not that system for Columbia, but adapting something to Columbia's specific needs. And so we did start a project with our Planning and Zoning Commission late 2014. We've had a number of staff presentations of information on the scorecard concept with them. We've discussed the difference between different ways of measuring. Proximity is easy to administer. If you say, is the tract on or near a major arterial road, that's very easy to calculate. If you say, is it on a road that is operating at an acceptable level of service, that's going to require some additional analysis. So we've run through some of those ideas with them. We've talked with them about what infrastructure would we like to include on our scorecard. Are we looking at roads and sewers, water supply, you know, the typical linear type features that you think of as infrastructure? Are we also adding in public facilities, distance from a fire station, whether or not the schools at all grade levels are at, below, or above capacity? Are we going to look at green infrastructure, this kind of thing? So we've put those ideas out there, and then we've talked about the goals. How are we going to use this thing? Is it just going to be documentation that gives us a new way of describing proposed development? Are we going to use it to require or at least encourage growth in the most cost-effective manner? These are all still open questions. We've gotten some feedback from them. I do believe the commission wasn't really comfortable with assigning point values, at least not initially. I think they want to allow a system to evolve, because you can get bogged down in point scales and saying, okay, who decides what those are and what do they mean?
Are you aware of any other communities using a grading system like that, that are actively using it to control or regulate growth?
Point systems,
there's an
example that got some play in the planning literature quite a few years ago. It was Hardin County, Kentucky at one time. They had a very unusual zoning system where they made everything the conditional use, and those that you follow zoning know that means you have to go and ask approval for that, and they use their point rating system to determine whether the conditional uses would get approved. And in contrast, most zoning allows most uses as of right, provided the zoning district is appropriate for the use, okay? So they use their point system to help them evaluate these conditional use requests. The system actually, if I remember correctly, it won a planning award. However, it was found to be not constitutional because, again, it goes a little too far in the way of conditional. Conditional uses are meant to be exceptional, not the norm, I think. So I'm not an expert on
it. That's
a historic example of a point system.
It would seem as bad.
Point systems are very common in all kinds of planning where you have to decide among priorities. To me, that's where they hold the best value is. You got a number of, I mentioned the 100-acre point system. A 100-acre point sewer means the city builds sewer and it goes to the last 100 acres in the watershed, meaning then private industry or private development be responsible for building out the rest of that watershed as to sewer. To determine who is eligible, there's a point rating system, and that's in the city policy resolution. So that's an example of in our own experience internally use that. MoDOT uses point rating systems all the time when there are competing grant requests. And you use it as a conversation starter. I would caution against a point rating system where it would be a black box kind of thing where you turn a crank and you say, well, you came out with an 83, you get to pass go. But you use it as a reference, and you can also use it as basis of comparison.
So if it's used as a reference and basis of comparison, I'm trying to figure out how you can have a scorecard that doesn't have scores.
Yeah.
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 So if it's reference and...
You have good, fair, poor, you know, that kind of values that are more ordinal, I guess.
But the information seems to be very valuable to a developer, though, that if they're considering a zone or area to develop in that has the infrastructure for them to go in and be successful. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could do a very elementary system where it's zero or one, presence or absence. Yeah. That's real easy.
Yeah.
Is there sewer available at the site? Well, there's not. You just got zero on that. If there's a sewer there, is it up to a standard? Is it an 8-inch sewer serving a residential tract? You know, and we do have standards we could reference, so you could have points in between for, oh yes, it's available, but oops, sorry, it's deficient in diameter. It will not do the kind of duty that you want it to. So you could have that kind of system. Personally, I favor in the early going more of a narrative approach. You let these things evolve. You then, through your narrative evaluations, by that I mean we would do fairly detailed looks at the tracts, how they sit with respect to available infrastructure, the condition, the capacity, and not just does the pipe meet the standard, but does what's downstream meet the standard? And you report all that, and people talk about it. And then as you go, as you begin to work through a number of these examples, then you can drop in, I think, some point rating systems. And the reason I say that is just, I think we could do something that looks real elegant, and it's got, you know, point scales all over it, and then first example, we apply it to, it isn't working so well, or we're tending to argue about why did we use a 10-point scale for sewer and a 5-point for roads and this kind of thing. And you want it to be about the, you know, is the project not only appropriate for the site, but is it advancing what we're in the business of doing, which is making sure that we are doing sustainable development, you know, whether it's the next track down the line or whether it's making sure the capacities are available in the systems that serve it. You know, we're not robbing anyone up or downstream of capacity. You know, those are the kinds of questions, I think, that need to be answered. And you can do that through this more narrative approach. But yeah, I have no objection to point systems, and if you all came out with a recommendation that you heard me speak and you did some of your own research and you think there should be a point system, that doesn't bother
How
me.
How far along are you on the development of your scorecard?
We've just shown examples and lists of criteria.
Early stages.
We and the commission, I think where we left it, and like I say, we diverted to the development code. And our poor commission, I thought I saw one of our members pop his head in. They're meeting weekly now with special work sessions to do this, to give it the time it deserves. Once it gets to council, which we hope will happen after October, we can get back to scorecard work. And I think the commission wanted to see us put some examples, just put something we can react to in front of them. So that'd be something we could do.
My concern about a stiff point system like that is you might have somebody higher up in the chain that the development might not make so much sense, but they can meet the points. And then maybe two people down further, and 2 acres or however much further down, their development makes great sense, but, well, there's already been 2 more people do it, and it's a snowball effect where everything gets worse and worse as you go down further, either out of town or wherever you go. And that's the thing I see, because and then everything compiles on one another when, hey, maybe the third guy had the best idea, and it wasn't, but 1 and 2 got through first, and those were bad ideas. That things happen like that all the time.
So maybe think about something that would offset that.
Right, yeah. And I don't ask me how to do that, because I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, I know what you're
getting. I'm just saying, you know, the first guy in the room isn't always the best guy in the room.
Right. So my last bullet here is, you know, this is a question. Do we design it? Do we design a system, a rating system that's fairly complete and ready to go? It's been vetted and then just use it. Or do we evolve it by saying we're going to start out kind of modest? Maybe we have a checklist of topics to address. We address them in a little bit more narrative fashion. And when I say narrative fashion, I don't mean non-technical. We'd ask our city experts to help us with technical evaluations. You know, so I'm just saying we wouldn't necessarily start assigning values until we get a little bit more confidence. And I think if people could see examples of this kind of reporting on proposed development, it might gain some support for doing that. Our typical analysis now is land use compatibility and site suitability. You look at the tract and you say, with the distribution of natural features on it, the shape of the parcel, is it suitable for that use? Will everything fit? And then you look at the surroundings, the immediate surroundings. Is it compatible with the land use? Okay, you have similar height structures on one side. You've got farming on another side. You've got a commercial district on another. Gee whiz, it seems to be compatible. I mean, that's been the kind of typical zoning analysis you do. To dig a little bit deeper, we'd look at, well, what's it going to take to service this thing? And we'd look at, okay, where are the sewer lines coming from? What are the characteristics of the system in that neighborhood or in that watershed? Roads, you look downstream, what are the intersections that are going to be affected by the traffic flows from that development? You know, storm, you look at what's the natural trend of the drainage, and then are there any existing problems that need to be remediated? Will they be exacerbated by this development, or is there a plan to handle that? Segue into development code, and just to give you a little general introduction, I'm guessing that a number of you are following it, but just to give you kind of a broad brush overview, our consultant came up with a nice way of thinking about not only zoning, but what we call the Unified Development Code, where there's subdivision regulations in there, and there's even elements from the sign chapter, the whole sign chapter's in there, and parts of 12A, the Land Preservation Code, are in there as well. So it's one binder that contains what we hope are all the ordinances you need to refer to when you're talking about development approvals. So to break all that down to some kind of manageable framework, they suggest, think about it this way. Okay, the districts and the permitted uses chapters, that addresses the question, what can be done with property and where? And then the part that deals with form and development standards, which is generally site-specific requirements, that's how good does it have to be? How much landscaping and open space do we have to have? How much parking? Where can the access points be? How tall can the building be? You know, where can buildings be placed with respect to other property? All of those kind of questions are addressed in that kind of midsection, and that's actually the largest amount of content, and that's also probably the part that gets the most public comment. And then the procedural side and the enforcement side, which is who grants permission and how. And I think all of these three parts do have implications for infrastructure, because if you're talking about how we assign uses to districts, well, what you look for in a good district structure is, does it promote harmonious land use combinations, or are we putting things that naturally fight together? And of course, things that naturally fight would be putting residential with production plants, because they're generally not thought to be compatible with land use. You keep residential traffic away from 18-wheeler traffic. You keep all day, all night operations away from sleeping and peace and quiet operations. So this kind of thing. And then, of course, the intensity of zoning has a lot to do with potential service demands. So density of the different types of use is going to be a clue as to what kinds of infrastructure investments have to be made. On the form and development standards, one of the things that I think we probably don't talk enough about, we talk a lot about costs and how to distribute costs. We talk about needs and what projects need to be planned. Do we talk enough about design and planning and creating value through design? If we thoughtfully lay out our subdivisions, if we somehow could get all of our residential subdivisions to connect with one another, that would be a cost-saving design, as I'm sure you can appreciate. So that's another thing to look at is, are we promoting good access and circulation? Will the Public Works Department be able to plow streets more efficiently because we've given some thought to how our streets are laid out and designed. So service efficiencies are possible through design and planning. So you can take a look at our development standards with a view to it. And then on the who grants permission, I mean, rezoning, any change in zoning, is a legislative act. It's at the discretion of the city council. Council needs to have the benefit of some kind of analysis. And so, we have in our code some procedural requirements that speak to that. What is the information that we're asking developers to provide? And is it sufficient to make an informed decision? And then do we have some evaluation criteria? In other words, how do we know when it's good enough? How do we know what questions to ask of it? So those kinds of things are dropped into the procedural section of the development code. The references to infrastructure, we don't zone infrastructure in the same way we zone the structures that are actually inhabited, but there are some references here in the case of zoning changes or rezonings. We've got a paragraph in there that requires an analysis to be performed of infrastructure capacities. For subdivision, site analysis data. By this we mean we're going to be asking, and this is the draft code, mind you, but in its present form, there would be some additional information that we're not asking for now. We'll typically, we do get topographic surveys, we do get aerial photos, but this would be an actual analysis of where are the sensitive areas on a site, where are the slopes that you ought not to be building on or disturbing, where are the stands of trees that are subject to our tree preservation ordinance, where's the floodplain, where's the wet areas, where are the bad soils, this kind of thing. And this with the idea that we can then look at the lot layout, street layout that's proposed, and we can require the adjustments necessary to avoid undue damage or impacts to those sensitive areas. There's sufficiency of resources language in the subdivision part as well. And, you know, it's general. It's not technical. There's not a... Ordinances typically don't say, here's how you calculate all of this, but they put the practitioner on notice that it's expected that they will provide some justification that their project is capable of being serviced with either existing utilities or an infrastructure or things that they will build as part of the project. So conditional use permits the same. And then planned districts, here's an aside, I'm sure those of you that are in the business are aware one of the go-to moves of the city over probably the last several decades has been to rely on the planned district technique to negotiate and exact infrastructure improvements. Consultant was quick to point out that that's a very exhausting process, and it contrasts with high-impact developments that are in the conventional districts where development can occur as of right. So there's kind of a asymmetry there of process. We're not getting rid of planned districts, and we're not getting rid of them, or we're not reducing their role for that reason. But we're suggesting that planned districts be applied where there is land in a developer vision of development of that land. It doesn't fit the other districts. The earliest planned districts were apartment complexes that would put 12 buildings on a single tract. And the way the old zoning ordinances were written, they said you can only put one building on each lot. And so that's a classic example of a reason for doing PUD circa late 1950s, early 1960s. They did it because they said, my concept is I'm going to put a number of rental buildings on a single campus-like tract. It's all going to be under one ownership and control. It's going to have a green space in between it. It's not going to have traditional one building on one lot the way your code contemplates. And so lawyers created this tool to accommodate innovative and out-of-the-box type development. Conservation of open space, it's a great technique for shifting buildings around to maximize open space on a tract where it's most needed, because that's where the sensitive features are, and that might violate some of the setbacks that are done in abstract terms on a lot, but you get a better result because you're allowed that flexibility to move those buildings into areas where the setbacks say they don't normally belong, but you can say I've just saved you 20% of the trees that I would otherwise be removing.
So, Tim, can you give an example of where of what the shift might look like here? Like, what's something that was developed as a planned unit development here that wouldn't be?
I would say many of the what I call a regular rectangular lot on an existing street.
Okay.
Generally speaking, in those cases, there's really no need, unless there's some unusual topographic features, and that could be present, there's not a need to do those as planned unit development. But what we have gotten is a use of the technique to become that in-between district. I've got a site, and I want to do my, I'll think of a use. I'll pick on, we've done some uses where the use that the developer wants to build is acceptable, but the full range of the commercial district is not. And so the way to get to yes is use a plan development technique and say, I'm going to self-restrict to just this handful of uses that I know will be considered appropriate. By so doing, you've created really a new district that's halfway between one and the other. What we're saying is we want to craft zoning districts where you have enough confidence in the standards that you'll get a quality product, even if you don't use the planned district technique.
So John Ott's lots at St. James and East Ash, those were ended up being a planned development because of negotiating uses.
Well, I know there's C2 there. Yeah, he did a covenant technique.
That's right.
Yeah, he did a covenant technique where he reached a private agreement to self-restrict.
So, we have a controversial one. Under this process, what would happen to the Amir Ziv project from a few years ago?
There's still PD zoning there. We are not proposing in the development code to change any existing planned districts, and we'll cover this in our full presentation on the code. What we'll do is refer all those tracts to the original ordinances, the approved development there. An owner such as Mr. Ziv would have the option of recoding this property to something in the new ordinance, but it's a legacy zoning.
Well, I meant just hypothetically.
If he was doing it
today. With that project today, how would that fit?
If he was doing it today, he would request a cottage standard, and he would lay out according to the standards of cottage housing. There is I think it's at least 3,000 square feet per unit that would have to be provided, if I recall.
Okay. How about Cottage Grove on West Broadway?
Cottage Grove on West Broadway?
Yeah.
That would probably, because the parking is not unit specific, you got a shared parking area that's concentrated, which, by the way, I think is another identifier of a PD.
Right.
That's the flexibility you want. That would probably be best done under a PD if you wanted to replicate it under this code.
New plan. Okay.
Yeah. Unless we've revisited R2, which was the original zoning there, and just said we're going to include that flexibility.
I just find it, because what I found odd when we did that, we could have went in there and put a cul-de-sac in there and put a whole bunch of nasty duplexes in there, but instead we decided to make something better, and we had to fight nail and tooth to make it happen. So it's, I don't know, I find there's that we have to work through.
Yeah. You're saying that it would be handy to enable that from the get-go in that zoning district, because then you could go ahead and present your plan and say, look, it conforms to some of the options. Yeah, it's not too late to write that kind of flexibility in that district. I think we're still thinking of R2 as it's primarily a single two-family building program where you find it. But that's a good thought if we have, because we do have another large tract that's owned R2, as you're aware, down the street.
Very large. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
5-something acres. Yeah. And do we want it ugly or do we want it nice?
Right. And you're saying as a developer, you made the choice to take the harder procedural road.
My mother would have killed me if we would have put duplexes there. Yeah.
No, that's a good project.
Just thinking out loud. Because we could have went under what was there. We could have went the easy way, but we didn't.
And then the city would get another street that would have to plow unless you worked something out, requested a private cul-de-sac. So we're better off in that sense not having another cul-de-sac. So
just thinking out loud.
Yeah, this is some of the text I'm referring to, and I get the feeling, and I'm sure this will get scrutinized, but people that commented to Clarion directly or submitted comments on this topic, this idea of sufficiency of resources, will think, is this all there is? Because there is this, I think there's an expectation created the development code will be a great leap forward in our infrastructure planning. But I would submit to you that it's not an infrastructure planning document. Its infrastructure is one of the criteria you absolutely need to look at when making land use decisions, and I think it can help us in that regard. But this is a paragraph for any rezoning, and it says, the department, meaning community development, will make a written recommendation to the commission as to whether the proposed change conforms to the city's adopted comprehensive plan and whether adequate utilities, storm drainage, water, sanitary sewer, electricity, and other infrastructure facilities are available to support development that would be enabled by a proposed zoning map change and the expected results of the proposed change. The reason we're undertaking that analysis is if it's just zoning, if it's Tony Grove or Cody Darr saying my client or myself wants to change this from one zoning district to another, but they're not specifying what they're going to build, we have to look at the range of possibilities. So we will take that on. If it's something like a subdivision situation or a conditional use, we have similar language, but it's developer's obligation to provide statements because they know what they want to build. They know how they're going to serve it. They've done some due diligence on the capacity of this system. Whereas the staff can look at not what they might be talking about doing in the future or thinking about doing in the future, but what that district allows from most intense to least intense. So we give our commission and our council the benefit of some opinion on whether we think we're putting 10 pounds in a 5-pound container or not.
That sounds a lot like a scorecard.
We can use the scorecard in that fashion. We can bring them together. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. These aren't independent. They're separate projects for now.
Yeah, the UDC doesn't make any reference to a scorecard. It does make reference to sufficiency of resources.
Right. Right. We don't have, that I'm aware, a statement that says staff shall use or developer shall attempt a score or something like this. There's no reference to it.
So, and there was some criteria you said, even though it was not really technically specific, for the sufficiency of resources tests.
Yeah.
So there is that language in the...
Right.
In the UDC.
Right.
So Cody, then, is like, if it were to go to like a scorecard, you, from you day-to-day, the work you do, if a scorecard system was used with the city versus all of the codes and everything that you guys make plans and do everything off of, are those even meshable? Or is it, will there be so much mush in between there that it'll be hard to...
I foresee it as putting what is already done into one place, because I feel like each department does that themselves, and then when they review a project, whether it be annexation or a subdivision, they make comments about that, but you're putting it all into one spot. So I don't necessarily see it as being contradictory to what we do now. It's just a kind of a different way to go about it. The real big question with the infrastructure scorecard, which you touched on, was how are you going to use it? Is it going to be regulatory? Is it just a reference? And what is the nature of the scorecard? Which, I mean, obviously you are working through that now, and that's a big part of how you guys will continue to work through it. So I'll be interested to see how that goes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're obligated to say when things are insufficient, you know, in our own opinion. And everybody has entitled their own opinion, too, that look at it. So it's going to be a conversation starter, would be what I'd say. The danger of making it completely regulatory is then it draws undue attention to that system itself, in my opinion. Whereas if you're just using it to say, well, we attach some values to this, and whether you use good, poor, fair, acceptable, unacceptable, or a numerical rating, you know, it's going to produce comparisons. Tony made a good point about the timing too in an area. You know, I see it all the time where we have tracts that are left behind. There's a first wave, there's a second wave of development, then there's a backtracking to those harder to develop pieces because the strength of the market is such that, you know, now it's valuable. It wasn't before because it had some deficiencies, but, you know, as the market strengthens in an area, there's still housing demand, there's just a scarcity of sites. You get those, you tend to get poorer sites last in, you know, all the time. So some way of dealing with that issue too, I think, needs to be part of this.
Right. I mean, but they would be a separate analysis that happens between sort of the quality of the property, the and infrastructure capacity, right? So that's...
How does this address redevelopment, for example, like at the downtown community area where you're taking a group of private houses and maybe small commercial businesses and building a high-density building unit?
I suspect there's going to be more to the site analysis because you have to take into account what is it replacing. what was the infrastructure built for that's there now? Is there historic value to what's on the site? Is there a pattern of curb cuts?
The process is
already in place.
The process is the same. It's just done at a little different level.
You're instead of commenting on natural features, you're going to be commenting on built features for the most part. Maybe some natural features, depending on how much open space there is. But yeah, I would see the system as being built for all types of development, but you would have to recognize that, yeah, we're now looking at maybe second or even third generation development of a piece of ground instead of pure greenfield development. And then you look at condition of infrastructure becomes more important generally, because you're going to have it there. If there's a building there, there's going to be some facilities, and then you're evaluating the condition of them. And, you know, we've talked about, we've talked about condition of sewers extensively as a community. You know, we've talked about whether water systems deliver fire flows and that kind of thing. So, yeah, that would be part of it. The biggest apartment building that we have going now in downtown, I'll use that as an example. They built some new sewer.
So it's a rise.
Down 9th, rise on 9th.
How many stories is that? Is that a 6-story facility?
10.
10-story?
Yeah. And they built a connection to what will be a brand new sewer along Elm. And by doing that, they took the line. They offloaded from the line that was serving the several buildings that were there. Granted, they're producing a lot more. I mean, they're going to produce a lot more impact. But that's a point that should be included in a redevelopment analysis. You look at factors like that, there's more line capacity being established with the new development. And I think it's important not to overlook those factors. What the utility department found is they flow tested those existing lines and then found that it would not accommodate what the rise is going to put on it, so they remediated that by building.
So are they going to go down 9th Street down?
They went 9th to Elm.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's a line that runs all the way down Locust. There's a line that runs all the way down the alley, if I remember correctly,
okay.
Several blocks. And so what I'm saying is the flow that went that direction has now been from the James and from the Quintons has now been, and the seafood restaurant has been offloaded. So minor offset, but, you know, again, if we're going to get deep into these things, we want to bring up all those things, do a description of kind of the area, not just the particular site.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of the communication process for this? It's, you know, it's pretty evident for sufficiency of services or scorecards, the negotiation or conversation at the project initiation developer end. Where, I mean, one of the things we've been sort of asked to look at is, you know, how does everybody know where things are? So where's the reporting niche in that process where the community has a sense of what needs are going to be created by a project?
Well, I suppose that'll be fully resolved only when we get the Plan Commission to make a recommendation to council on how to adopt it. To draw on the Boone County example, the staff uses it, so it's going to get reference in their reporting. And that's what I expect for us, is we would, whether you go ahead with a formal scorecard or not, I would expect us to do kind of the deeper analysis, because that's what the public is demanding, that's what council needs, is that additional information. So I would say in staff reports on this, which would be part of reporting to the Planning and Zoning Commission. Is that what you're... driving at?
In order, just to add, I don't know exactly if this is what you're speaking to, but have the criteria that your report is based on be transparent or, you know, in the ordinance or in this code, enough that while the developer's not going to be asking you, won't be able to see what your report is, he knows what you're going to be grading the proposed development on, so he can get an idea of what he needs to be looking at with his proposed development.
Right. And so that everybody across the board has sort of a consistent set of expectations yeah. about what we can know about what developments are going to be.
And I think Cody's said this several times. If you know, if a developer knows going into something, not that I want it to be more expensive, but if it is and you can plan for it, then you can go to your bank and talk to them about that. Mm-hmm. You can't upfront horrible, like, after the fact surprises. You can't have that needs to be fixed.
These are just some of the references. I won't dwell on this, but conditional use permit, not a large part of the overall development picture, but these are usually individual uses that have been determined appropriate for a zoning district, but not every site within the zoning district. So currently the Board of Adjustment looks at those such uses. And they render, you know, an example is a private lake. You want to build an artificial lake and it's an amenity to a residential project. You go to the Board of Adjustment for that and they determine whether, you know, there's appropriate safeguards for the location. Is it an appropriate site to excavate such a facility on? Maybe not. We're going to have those, first of all, go to Plan Commission and then to Council. So it'll actually be an example of a process that we are making lengthier in terms of steps. But the thought is it's really a development proposal. It's not in the nature of an appeal, which is what the Board of Adjustment is generally in the business of hearing. And truthfully, a lot of communities do send those things to their Boards of Adjustment or Board of Appeals. But this is a recommended practice to bring it to the planning and zoning. And they'll look at infrastructure issues as part of that. Zoning amendments, that's when there's a plan district, we're indicating that the application shall document whether adequate utilities, storm drainage, water, sanitary sewer, electricity, and other infrastructure facilities are available to support the proposed development. In other words, we're not just going to want your standard application materials, the 1-inch to 50-foot plan of what's being built, but also a statement. How does it not, or how does it actually, how is it actually served by adequate infrastructure? And as I say, in many of our cases, there's a proposal to build some off-site or build a larger than standard facility to make that happen, so that could be considered by the commission and the council.
So like some type of like a specification book or something submitted with a drawing, or what do you?
It would be a narrative statement, and it might be supported by some data, And you're going to do it in consultation with departments. You always have to get the information about where facilities are and that sort of thing. But we're going to want to report to our commission that the developer says this is why you should consider this adequate infrastructure.
How far downstream would that report cover?
That's going to depend on how big it is. That's going to depend on, there's going to be judgment.
Adequate utilities, but just at the site?
I'm suggesting we look up and downstream in all cases, but how far down? I mean, that's going to be a matter of judgment, quite honestly. I don't think we can reduce it to a linear measure or something, because there's going to be big developments that have very major impacts. What's that?
All the way to the treatment plant.
Well, you always look at treatment plant capacity, right? That's the first question we're always asked: is do you have capacity in your plant
for utilities that can be
every
modeled
day,
for your model
arranged?
Well, I mean, utilities that can be modeled. Modeling analysis needs to be done so that because you don't know where that bottleneck is going to be. It may be 2 miles down the road.
Correct.
This is where that comprehensive hydraulic models of the sewer and storm sewer networks that the utility departments have said they are interested in would be a
very advantageous
electric
for us.
Water, your systems are already modeled. Is that right? To electric? I know your electric is going to be water.
The water system is, the electric is not real modeled at the distribution level.
The problem, or not the problem, but one of the challenges I'd see with that statement that you have about the application documenting whether adequate infrastructure is available, well, there's certain cases that are pretty black and white, and if, you know, there's models that, you know, have all the information that the city has, you know, you're pretty black and white. There's, I foresee, like, for example, streets where in some cases the city requires us to document whether adequate you know, street capacities exist, a traffic study, which we're in some cases required to submit, which we are documenting whether we believe there's adequate infrastructure or what improvements should be made. Although that's where that negotiation comes in, because if it's not adequate, what percentage is put onto the developer? Mm-hmm. And even some cases, it's even more than that, where this, the developer's application suggests that it is adequate and the city staff says it's not adequate, and then you're going back and forth like mm-hmm. that. So that statement could be, I mean, yeah, it's nice to say that, but to have that, but you still, I could still foresee there being, you know, conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
That not being an end-all be-all
yeah.
or anything.
We could write code all day long. We'll never come to a argument-settling text. I mean, we'll always have the arguments, I think. You know, but this is in the realm of just expectations of what information the commission's going to expect to hear. They're going to say, staff, has there been a statement made? Let's hear from both you and the applicant on that score. You like it when you agree, of course, because then you know, we're seeing eye to eye and we're not asking them to choose. But we're going to have those occasions where we just say we're not buying what they're offering up, and it might be a traffic study methodology question. Maybe you looked at capacity. Maybe we think more should be done with safety. There's a site distance or something. I mean, that's on occasion. That's a component of you know, a traffic study.
And I'm not as worried about the what is the deficiency, because I think engineering, you can kind of come to a consensus to that, but the harder part to me is the allocation of what's this project responsible for impact wise.
Right.
And that's where it'd be nice if we could suggest something, or suggest that somebody else look at making a suggestion by hiring a consultant or something, or doing traffic studies in regional areas that could come up with a objective way to address that. Mm-hmm. As opposed to just case by case negotiation, each site's a new day kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So sort of guideline. I understand the idea of the importance of judgment and looking at individual situations, but some standards or guidelines that everyone can plan on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do have some thoughts on that in my wrap up here. And this is to give you a sense of just kind of in the practice of development review, some of the ways we have dealt with infrastructure issues that come up in development, and what we can do, things that we could do different. At the top of the list here would be, we could certainly document more. Like I say, a standard zoning analysis, you always hear the northeast, southwest, what's on each side of the particular tract. That's mainly because we want to analyze compatibility. Are you going to get in somebody's view? Are you going to drain on somebody's property right into their basement? You know, this kind of thing. But we can take a broader view and look more particularly at, if it's a sewer issue, we look at the characteristics of the system in that area. We say, there's no reported issues, for example. You can say, we haven't had any complaints about infiltration or overflows or anything like that, or perhaps we have. So that would, I think, one might make for some longer sessions, but it at least puts everything out there that we're indicating all the potential impacts that are going to be associated with that that project. And we can also look at what value is being added. You know, are the things that you're building, are they going to be adding some strategic value to the city? Or are they going to, you know, by creating an alternate route, are they going to be actually an asset to our road system? I mean, yeah, there's always the maintenance. You create new public streets, so we got to think about years and years of maintenance at, you know, $10,000 a mile, that kind of thing. But, you know, there might be some offsetting benefits of that. So it's an opportunity for us to cite those kinds of things. Some of the things we do is we will occasionally take payment in lieu of improvements when something is deficient. The way this should properly work is, it kind of to Cody's point, is it should be a proportionate share payment for infrastructure. We shouldn't be asking that you fix the problem that was left to us in 1890 or 1950 or whenever it was that a deficient system was put in place, but you shouldn't exacerbate the problem either, that kind of thing. An example of proportionate share would be, very often we have major roads that are on our plan. Providence Road would be an example. We got a plan that shows both existing and proposed future Providence Road, and where that falls on a tract, we ask that subdivider to provide the full right-of-way for eventually a four-lane road. But we recognize that what they build may not ever require in and of itself a four-lane road to get access, to get people in and out of there. So the actual proportion built might be equivalent to a residential street, two-lane. And that's actually in the city code, and I don't know if you reviewed that section in Chapter 24, but that's in the code that the city council may contribute to upsize a facility when that kind of thing occurs. An example where a developer front-loaded an improvement, Southampton Road, if you've been down there by Sinclair, you'll notice Southampton now extends all the way from State Farm to Sinclair Road. That was a development project where we pointed out that the major roadway plan called for that extension. They agreed to build the road, and they agreed to build it at about a 38-foot width with no contribution from the city. So that was at developer cost. It is a public roadway. And so that's an example where we said, if you're going to wait for us to build it, it's going to be a good long while before the city builds it. It's on our plan, but you're going to be at the mercy of the capital budgeting process. So they agreed to front load because they wanted to move their assisted living facility.
Did they request the extra width and fitness or thickness ordinance to apply?
I don't recall that they did. That's what I say. I think it was...
They just offered.
They did it. They did it. That would be, you know, I would argue to just use that facility, you don't need a collector road, but we do need a collector road for all the connected neighborhoods. So that's an example of front-loading where we can say that. We can say, look, we'd like to help you, but we got all these other projects well ahead of you, but you have the option of doing it yourself, be our guest, kind of thing. So that's a scenario that can come up.
So what do they get besides the ability to do their project for doing that?
There was nothing.
You don't get a tax deduction?
No.
Or, yeah.
No.
It's just business.
Yeah. Yeah. We do a lot of development agreements, have done. Typically a development agreement is going to specify both the city obligations and the developer obligations. Most often there are things that are going to happen very quickly after the development is approved because they're needed for that project, but they can also address things like staging, and this also goes to, are we making them build too much up front, or is it appropriate? So we have a staging in place, for example, with the Conley Road, what's called the Conley Road Extension. I think it's actually East Boulevard to Conley, north of Broadway Marketplace, the giant shopping center with Lowe's and Sam's Club and all that. It's a bridge over the Hinkson, so it's a very major development. It's an agreement with the developer and the TDD that's been formed there, and it recognizes that their traffic study showed that it's not needed to serve what they have and some of what they're building, but when they build another large box, we want them to have that in place. So we did defer the completion of that particular improvement through a development agreement.
And additional large boxes would be north?
Yeah, there was a MoDOT maintenance barn there that they acquired, relocated. So, yeah. And so there's an agreement on that. And, you know, we had an agreement on Auburn Hills, the development way up north, where the developer agreed to do four-lane road. Four-lane road was not absolutely necessary to provide access to just the quantity of housing that they were building. But it was on the roadway plan as a major facility because we wanted to interconnect 63 and Rangeline, and then ultimately west of Rangeline. And so they agreed to do the road surface, and then the city, by agreement, contributed the pedestrian facilities. So that was, you know, it was a negotiated thing. There was no formula that said in code, you do the road, we'll do the sidewalks. It was a negotiated thing. It was based on what the developer was willing to do. It made their development look better because it's a complete road. It's not a half road left for the city to do when it has resources. And I think that was one of the things that was operating there, is they cared about a finished appearance and as well wanted to make a contribution to the the roadway plan implementation. So that's another example for you on how those kind of things work. And those are some of the better examples. We collected a contribution for Green Meadows Road when that was extended. So it's kind of the go-to move when there's a major public facility that one of our master plans indicates ought to be built on the track and someone announces that they want to do a project. Now, there's things we can do different with this. You want to see more predictability. I mean, we could put some general information about when is a development agreement going to be required. Just put that information out there, put it on the web, put it in our application materials. What are you typically going to be expected to do? Here's kind of some guidelines. You know, I think we could do that. We might even get our law department to write kind of a shell document with at least the boilerplate provisions that we're going to want. I haven't talked to them about it, so I don't know if they'll do that. But, you know, that to me would be a service, you know, that would at least create some measure of predictability, maybe save you a little bit of early wheel spinning in the process, because you could talk to your banker about, look, this is how they present the problem. We're going to have to agree on a number, but we kind of know how where it's going to be.
How did you like how it worked with Somerset Village, where there was development agreement, obviously, but there was a regional traffic study that was done that allocated impact fees for different uses, residential lots or office or commercial. So they proposed to rezone it, and obviously there was some major infrastructure, arterial street, that they had to build before they could even start developing, which the city agreed to let them. There was a traffic study in place that had this fees that they were going to have to give to the city, but the city was willing to credit them some of the improvements that they were going to build themselves, mm-hmm. like the arterial road battle or
widening St. Charles,
a roundabout, stuff like that. So they could use that as credit against those fees. Did you like how that worked? Because that was very predictable. You knew what the fees were going in. You knew what you could do on your site, and that would be credited, and there would be the remaining fees that...
Yeah, in my parentheses here, this Northeast Area Traffic Study is referring to exactly what you're talking about, where the county took the lead on doing the study. They did the study. It produced a dollar value based on assumptions about what the ultimate build-out would be of that planned area.
So
we had the benefit of the plan. We had some traffic numbers that could be attributed then to the different areas of development. You have to make assumptions. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, you have to assume that that whole area is eventually going to build out.
But that way the cost generated, you know, that you're paying is going for mm-hmm. in the future, those improvements, yeah. you don't have to build them now necessarily. They aren't doing any good right now, yeah. but in 30 years, you might need battle extended Mexico yeah. gravel or whatever. And the city would have those yeah. funds because of the development through the years, yeah. you know, that is in that region that would be. I mean, you could argue about the numbers, but and how much, what percentage of those costs that the study said that these improvements that need to be made in the next 30 years cost. But as far as having a document and the transparency, I really liked that you could, you know, it's just yeah. right there. There it is. You're, yeah. you know, a lot's going to cost $7,000, which, I mean, to me, it was a little expensive, but it was right there. So yeah. they knew going in, there was no additional. You have to build this road, even though it's not going to be used for 30 years or whatever, you know. And there's triggers, like you had mentioned, like it did, like the roundabout or the widening of St. Charles doesn't have to be built until, you know, this portion of the property is developed, you know, with an actual construction, not just zoned and platted. mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a good system. The only drawback is we have to be able to focus on enough areas and put enough upfront expenditure into those studies, because without the study you don't have the basis for the dollars. But the 75% I thought was good, because you're not making them pay full freight, because you recognize that the roads that get built are occasionally used by people like me who live on the west side of town, but I might have some business at Battle. I might just want to drive out there and see what's going on, so I'm using the road system too, as are people passing through the area. So you want to recognize that benefited population by doing a proportion and assign it then to property.
I mean, obviously it takes a long time. There's a lot of different areas and different aspects, and it was very technically, you know, in depth. But if you could have something like that across the whole city in different regions and work towards that, you know, where you could have those, it'd be a little more of an even playing field. I mean, they would naturally not be the same in any given part of town, but at least in this region, it's a level playing field as opposed to, I don't know.
Can something like that work for redevelopment?
I mean, I don't know how that would work if you redeveloped in the Northeast Area Plan. Would you still be subject to the fees? Well, you probably wouldn't be subject to those fees unless there was some trigger to be subject to them, because it's a straight zoning.
There's
an existing business there.
Demolition and yeah. replacement.
Like one of those ABC labs or that area, yeah. you know.
Yeah. Yeah, normally in an if I don't want to call it an impact thesis, but it's not quite an impact fee. It's very similar. You do give credits for impacts that are already recognized. So, mm-hmm. yeah, if something's already producing traffic.
Yeah. It would be the difference, I guess.
Yeah.
And it would...
net increase in intensity.
Right. And the way our system's set up now, I don't know if you could capture that if it was a straight zone at this point in time, you know, because there just wouldn't be any mechanism for the developer to be required to pay that. But with this new development code, potentially, or if there was a new ordinance adopted or something.
Right. I'm probably over-catastrophizing here, because I tend to, but, you know, if you went with a zone sort of plan that was focused on supporting the new development process, you know, over time, would you have a resistance to just passing general, you know, capital improvement bonds? I mean, I wouldn't want to set up a situation where we were resistant to paying for existing areas and neighborhoods and what's already developed.
Well, I think you would, yeah, there would be a separate mechanism to pay for improvements to Broadway or something right. like that if all the redevelopment that happened there was just the same impact as what's currently being developed or was developed prior to the redevelopment, you know, because I don't think they necessarily should have to pay for that,
yeah.
maybe. I don't know.
I don't know.
But
yeah.
But, yeah, sure, I mean, for equity's sake, you know, if you redeveloped and it was a more intense use and it was in an older part of town, you should be associated some sort of impact fee, I would think, if you go with the philosophy of those regional traffic studies.
Right. I think it's harder to predict what a redeveloping zone or area is going to do than what, and sort of an opening up area. Like, I'm trying to think how that concept could apply, like, to the recent building boom in downtown.
Be less focused on surface infrastructure and be more focused on underground
infrastructure
in the downtown case.
Yes.
Like what happened, for instance, even with just road traffic alone, the new huge retirement center on Chapel Hill. What happened? I mean, what kind of, there was what, four houses there or something approximately mm-hmm. there? That I drive down that road every day. That road didn't get any bigger. And
no,
there's some parking, there's what, 150 parking spots there.
Yeah,
now.
Do you see a lot of coming and going though? Do you see like change of shift? Do you see a lot of on off?
That, but and I mean that, but buses and just I mean families coming to see the.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a lot of 9 year old people driving around. I get that, but still, there's four people coming to see their grandmother.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's something there to say.
Yeah, they get a lot of service delivery. I go visit one quite often.
You know, they're not going when everybody's going to work or everybody's coming.
Right,
home.
And I'm not.
So you got to look at that as a traffic engineer. What time of day are they actually coming?
Right, and I'm not picking up on it. I'm just saying that. I mean, there's what 100. How many beds are there now?
I don't remember their capacity, but I agree. It's
and it's not. It's, I think it's only like 20% full at this point. But you know, if you get on Sunday after church when a family of six comes and visits grandma. I mean, how many cars come in? You know, there's.
Well, that's where the thought of having increased development fee would be a level. I mean, I'm not necessarily rising to the conclusion that this should be our recommendation or this is the best way to do it, but I have gone around and given a lot of thought because it is equitable. You have the development fee increase, that's $3 a square foot, and that's regardless of your straight zone, plan zone, you know.
Because that just as easily could have been a dorm or a college apartment.
Yeah, it was R30. Yeah, you could have done a really dense.
And you have a much smaller parcel. You got an apartment across the street.
It's straight zone. I don't think there's any trigger for a traffic study to be done with that. Or if there was, I don't know what trigger there would have been to require the developer to make those improvements other than in front of his property, maybe widen in front of his property. You could have made him do that. But as far as up or down.
They didn't even put a turn lane or anything in.
But it was a very low use.
Right.
Well, 38-foot road. I'd put a turn lane in there with a
paper. Right. But does the new development code address that? I'm not as knowledgeable as I should be on the draft development code. But does it address that at all? The existing R3 zones, or you know, just for example, does it treat it more like a planned district now? Does it add any different
There are, the way I describe it is there's some enhanced design requirements. So I think while it's possible under almost any code to make something look ugly, and I will not guarantee you will never have an ugly building after development code passes, you do improve the probability of success aesthetically by having some additional standards in there. However, on the type of stuff you're talking about is would we have a mechanism where it's already subdivided site, it's already on a road? Do we have something that allows us to get those additional infrastructure improvements, even if it's a turn lane or something? I don't think so. I think it's all done through the subdivision process, so you kind of you miss your opportunity through subdivision. You live with...
But another big part of that, beside the street, that I think the neighbors were more concerned about was the sewer backups that were right behind that. So, I mean, we've talked about that quite a bit. But.
And that could go to this analytical piece where you look at the quality of the system that's being accessed. You know, how's it rated? You know, has there been any recent inspections of it? Has there been reports of complaints and things? And you gather that data and you have that conversation with the developer.
But like with a planned district, you guys would have a mechanism to make the developer pay for that downstream mm-hmm. trunk, or I don't know if it's a trunk line, but that downstream mm-hmm. sewer. Whereas a straight R3, you didn't have that mechanism mm-hmm. necessarily to say, you got to go downstream mm-hmm. 5,000 feet and fix all that sewer that's, you know, yeah. wet weather is or has inadequate
yeah.
capacity.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, and, you know, that may be something for council to take a long, hard look at. We may fall back on that. What I can tell you is we're going to go from these four different plan districts to one so that we at least have one process described and not four similar but different in some respects processes.
Yeah.
And then you'll have more flexibility on combining uses and things like that too. Because we're not, right now, what we call a PUD is only residential. That's all that's allowed in there. And then, oh, you're doing a shopping center that you want to be planned district, that's CP, etc. So we're going to say anything that you think is not necessarily tailored for one of our district offerings, you can propose as a PD.
So what is the...
It's going to have its own rules.
So what is the... Is the place on Chapel Hill the senior living place?
Provision Living?
Yeah, is it... Is that commercial?
That's an R3 district. It's very old R3 zoning.
Okay.
And it wasn't rezoned or in part or full any time recently, and it was occupied by those houses. Hilltop Drive,
Hillcrest.
I think it was, or Hillcrest is the name of the street that they vacated. And, yeah, they came in. They call it a continuum of care facility. There'll be another building. You know, they got the space for it. So.
That is something that I that we've sort of talked around on a couple different issues, but that is clearly a commercial enterprise. I mean, people live there, but they live there to be
somebody from out of town spent a lot of time and energy finding that one little spot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't have the time to do that. Yeah, bravo for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, you do see assisted living on commercial corridors all the time. Like I see around the country, these Sunrise assisted living. Personally, I feel they're better off in a residential environment. I mean, to
all
me,
those properties off of AC exit, like Boone Retirement and is it Tiger Place, are those all R3 properties?
A lot of them are office zoned.
Right.
But I mean, the retirement centers
OP.
Themselves.
Pardon?
The retirement centers themselves, like Boone Retirement. And
yeah, I think a lot of them are in the office district where we allow,
yeah.
we also allow that use.
It's Lenore's in the city limits, right?
Yeah, and they're a combination R3, I think R3 for, we have R301 over there, and I just can't remember what the majority of their building, it's such a big complex,
R3
it probably falls
huge
into both.
Right.
R3.
Yeah.
But I think there's a use and zoning difference that is important. I think that old people should get to live in residential neighborhoods too, but there, of course, but there is a an impact of the commercialization of care around people
mm-hmm.
that is much more like having a healthcare facility
mm-hmm.
in an area in terms of the traffic it generates and what comes on and off of that
yeah.
property than in a residential neighborhood.
Yeah.
And are we covering our cost of that appropriately as a community?
Yeah, I mean,
are you changing that CCRRC or however you define it in R3? Is that still going to be an allowable use? Are you changing that at all in R3 in the East Unified Development Code?
Trying to recall what we did. They did this.
They only allow assisted living. It's like a conditional type. If you meet certain criteria in R3, you can do assisted living. You can't necessarily do it in any case.
It's a nursing home. You probably can't. It's more medical.
No. Well, if there's
assisted living,
there's like different levels of assisted living. Yeah, and I don't know if that was one of the criteria. And I know the acreages was a criteria, and there was different other criteria that I can't bring to mind.
Continuum care refers to, it's usually going to be a mix of independent, assisted, and then skilled care.
Yeah.
not necessarily all brought online at once, but that's the master plan for it. It's a facility that allows, and a lot of times memory care then for Alzheimer's and other dementia patients, but they allow folks to move to different units in the facility as they age and become more fragile. I think there's good points here. We probably agree it's an in-between use or transitional use. It's got aspects of residential, but certainly it's, in building code we call that commercial construction because of the type of construction.
If it was apartment complex, it would have been commercial.
Right.
Right.
What it is.
Right.
Like, yeah. Because of the age of the people living.
Yeah.
Right.
But you don't recall if you have any revised.
I think we did revise how it's referred to. I just can't recall what the outcome was. Yeah.
But back to your point, Cody, is that if you're going to build something of that density and it's on a piece of property that it already has the zoning for, do we need to do something to correct the lack of participation in any downstream impacts?
I think it's worth looking at. I don't necessarily know if we should or not.
It just seems like having your zoning in place shouldn't be this gift that gets you your get out of jail free card.
We've talked about that before, haven't we? That the trigger needs to be something other than just than the rezone request.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, because in that example, you're saying that the infrastructure would have been built for just those handful of houses and then the single family that's around it, and then along comes this facility, and boom, there really isn't. They're not replanning the site. They're redeveloping the site, but they're not replanning it in any sense that we have that kind of control over.
If you look at the downtown, it's the same thing. You could have a residential neighborhood like East Campus. They want to tear a bunch of houses out, build a high-rise
old folks home.
Well, there would be old folks. It just could be, an apartment would be a commercial, but it could be an old folks home, retirement facility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing
and
I will say.
Maybe the infrastructure to handle that high density, because you took out 20 homes and built a unit that then was 400.
Yeah.
Is there any land for sale over there?
Over East Campus?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's zoned R3 or not. East Campus?
Much of
it. Yeah.
Is it R3?
There's two sections. The old the curvilinear streets are R1, but the portion that's closest to campus is mostly R3, and then there's some scattered tracts that were rezoned back to R1 or somewhere downzoned to R2 by the owners.
In the mid-90s.
Yeah.
So if someone bought a couple of houses and did a demo, and there would be no additional, and wanted to do something? I'm not asking for the answer. Would there be a trigger for sufficiency of services testing and all of that?
Well, all I can offer there is you already have the streets and infrastructure in place. You still have to meet fire flows, some very basic things. You can't have a congested sewer because the development is so intense. You have to have the water pressure necessary to fight a fire, so you occasionally with these redevelopment scenarios that you're describing, you get that kind of issue. The city will require the upgrades then. And then things like traffic, and I'm not talking about the East Campus example here, but just generally, if ever there's documentation that there's a negative result, an example would be Walgreens where we got the delineators. As you know, that started out full access for Walgreens. We had a traffic engineer documented that there were rear-end collisions there at an abnormal frequency, and we have the authority to go in and impose a control. So you do remedial things too. I think you raise a good point. It's when the land planning's been done in the sense that the lots are all created, the streets are all in place, but now guess what? The buildings are a lot more intense than what that infrastructure was planned for. What can we do? So that is probably is still something to look at. We can do an analysis, yes, but we have to take some additional steps if we want to have authority to require upgrades. I'm basically done. The one thing I didn't mention, but I'm sure you're aware of it, is we do have a transportation development charge. That's another option, of course, that's available. Very predictable, but again, you have to prepare all the materials, go to the voters, and that kind of thing. But it's in the nature of an excise tax. You're, unlike an impact fee, you're not spending it or not obligated to spend it in the same vicinity as the development creating the impact, but it just goes into a general pool and it's earmarked for, in our case, it's arterial and collector roads. So you can look at systems like that for roads or other infrastructure, but of course it's going to require the political process.
And then those funds would go into the general fund, or how would those be?
Yeah, they're recognized when capital projects are done. The public works director will report that a proportion of the funds, like if it's Scott Boulevard, they'll right. say sources of funds include sales tax, capital sales tax, development fees, that kind of thing.
They're so not earmarked project specific.
They're not required to be earmarked to a specific
project,
but they are required by ordinance to be spent on arterial roads. The theory being that, you know, I can use any arterial road to get to where I need to go in the city, so
right.
It's a general benefit. And if I build new stuff, I'm putting more impact on that system in general. So I'm going to allow the city to use some of what I pay into it to improve that system. That's all I had. I appreciate your questions.
Okay. Are there other
some things to think
time?
About?
Anything you want to with before he goes?
Is it all right if I stick around for the electric?
Absolutely. Yeah, because just to be clear, I see the timing, and when the developer starts Lotto and rezoning because they want it, and that's when they're in contact with you. Is that the time that the city wants to get involved as well as far as utilities units and roads?
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're where they're that. For a typical project, I'm sure we're sort of fast track, but by the time someone comes to you for a rezoning for development of a project to construction, how long does that typically take?
Rezoning's about a 3-month process. Construction, of course, it varies a great deal, but we actually have defined timelines on a commercial plan review, for example, anything that's like multifamily buildings and commercial buildings. We get our reviews done in 2 weeks. We get a re-review done in 1 week. So there's a amount of hold time where we're holding on to the plans that we can give you, but a lot of times there's intervals in between. You know, it takes time to redesign stuff and that kind of thing.
Rezoning,
so you gotta add that.
Assumes that any necessary studies or evaluations have been done in advance, so the developers actually does a lot more work well in advance of that. Do you find out about many of those projects, or we don't find about those projects until
it
comes to your doorstep?
It varies. There's some we hear about off and on for a year before someone pulls the trigger on it. You know, the part that we don't have any involvement at all is the private land market. You know, we don't control who's selling land. We don't get involved in the negotiations. And that's why I know there are transparency concerns, but when someone is asking us for information and we're aware that they haven't controlled a property yet, we're obligated to give them the information, but we don't create a permanent record of any type because that can really interfere with contractual matters. It's once they're announced that, you know, they've got control of the site and they want to do something with it, that we start creating records that are accessible to the public.
Yeah, just curious on basics. I know timing for utilities particularly take a long time. I mean, it takes a lot of time to get utilities in the ground to serve property.
Is there any break on how much work you'll do with them before a contract is executed? I don't think this probably happens very often, but that was definitely a perception with the Opus development, that they were getting lots of their groundwork done up front, intentionally delaying closing the contracts to sort of manage the issue.
Yeah, I didn't have a good feel for that at all. I mean, yeah, there might be a contract pending situation. Yeah,
that's more based
there.
On private.
But again, yeah, we don't ask for, show us your, we don't ask for proof of ownership. I mean, if there's ever a situation where the city's putting skin in the game, so to speak, like we're going to work on some kind of joint venture, we're going to own part of a development or something, yeah, then the law department might want to be advised of what the contracts say and that kind of thing, but we don't get involved in
You can make applications, you can have your plans reviewed, you can do all of those things.
You have to either be a contract purchaser with a signed contract, or you have to be the owner or the authorized agent of the owner.
Before the property. Staff will work on those pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Otherwise, just giving information. It's answering questions about where are the utilities, what condition are they in, those kinds of things. It's assisting with due diligence that folks may do.
I wanted to comment on the zoning. Certainly confusion. Like the Rise, I believe, is on C2.
Yes, sir.
If it had, I'm thinking the Rise is going to have a master meter for water, 3-inch master meter, which means the property is classified non-residential for sure. If the property had individual meters for sure, it'd be classified as residential. Correct.
Are you asking how is it metered? I think they're metered in accordance with the city ordinance, so they'll have individual.
They can have either one for water. They can have master meter or individual meters. I think if you're requesting individual.
Oh, you're talking water.
Water. I was thinking electric. But the water, the sewer's depending on the water. So if it got individual meters, the sewer is classified as residential. Right, John?
Or that level. It's always been.
Well, I'm just saying.
Unless you're commercial.
Or the sewer is non-residential.
Non-residential.
The master meters for the water, the sewer meter non-residential. The same building.
Probably.
So you got a building that's identical building, depending on how it's meter for water. Has a determination for the sewer residential or sewer is non-residential. But it's zone C2 commercial.
Yeah, but it's allowed in C2.
Yeah, I'm saying.
It's a zoning versus what you, it's not a definition. That use is allowed in C2.
Yeah. I just want to clarify that just because something's zone commercial, that means it's classified commercial and utilities.
Right, we got that a lot of this.
But isn't that, all mixed-use buildings are commercial, correct?
Zoning, but not use for utilities.
But isn't that, it's kind of splitting it
if you're
one way or the
water,
other?
If you're individually meter for water, your sewers run, and your sewers are classified as residential. If you're master meter for water, your sewers are classified as non-residential.
Your private lateral.
No.
Because
your
utility rate, that seems like a completely different thing than the zoning. Though.
It is. That's what I wanted to point out.
Yeah.
Do most cities have consistency between their utility use and zoning, or is this very common what we have here?
I've only lived here, so. The zoning. You know, normally the higher you go in zoning, if you start at R1 and you keep going up, let's say C2, those other uses below are allowed in C2. I mean,
yeah.
Not all of them, but
The building, when we talk about it as a commercial building in the building code, it follows the international building code, so it's commercial in that sense. It's an income property as a rental property, so it's commercial in that sense. people live there, the majority of the space is going to be used for living, so it's residential for those floors of it in that sense, and then they have commercial space facing 9th, so a part of it is commercial in the sense of selling goods and services for a tenant to be named later or tenants.
But utilities classify them different ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Every utility classifies them different.
Right.
I'm sorry.
But just even more confusing.
Yeah. Do you need information from us about how they're set up as far as how many water feeds and what size sewer and all that?
I think I've got it.
So this is an incredibly naive question, but if it's an intentional development of a mixed-use building, couldn't it be metered for the use and charged for the use? Charge the rates for that specific use? I mean,
Divided per unit, you mean?
Yeah.
Sure, there's no difference.
So on the C2 buildings, the new buildings downtown, can they just change their mind and rent those as any other use that's allowed in C2? Or do they have to stay residential?
Sewer's not using zoning definition for residential as residential. There, it's like residential for sewer is a totally different definition than zoning use. So we're trying to make those. They weren't. They just don't.
I'm just trying to think through whether or not we are, both consistently and fairly charging people for utilities across how they use their places.
Mixed use is complicated because you do have a commercial property and residential combined.
And is it, Bill, are you saying that because
there's a lot
it's
more of those.
Because it's zoned commercial, they have the option of a single meter, which they wouldn't.
No, they do zoning.
Right.
They got the option on water to go with.
Yeah.
Mash meter and meter meter.
It's a rates question. How rates are code.
Why do they have an option?
Why the code's written?
So they choose the master because it's going to be cheaper in the long run?
I assume.
And you're saying that's just water or electric?
No, electric. Electric so far. Mash meter is prohibited.
Right.
The rise.
So you can't have a master meter.
Not unless you meet that special condition on the, what was the special condition?
We had one on Nifong that they went to council with the request that the ordinance be amended.
Yes.
So it was amended, and council still has to approve it case by case.
Emergency power.
Was the plan district tied to backup generation?
Emergency power.
Emergency power or some form of, like, you had a net metering arrangement require something special that you couldn't do it individually meter, you'd have to do it with a master meter. You know, and that only be allowed in plan zone districts.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Appreciate your interest.
Thank you.
If there's anything I can follow up with.
Okay. Would you mind sending me a copy of your PowerPoint? Thank you.
It'll be posted on the Google site.
I'm sorry?
It'll be posted on the Google site.
Yes, and I, yeah.
Is it working again?
I was looking at it right before I came over.
It was working.
And it was working. I will say that there's some fairly significant updating that it's probably time to do for the project. So, I'll work with Carol and we'll get that figured out. So it's 8:54. So I think I will suggest that we table old business for tonight and do general comments.
I may revise my electric recommendations again if I meet with Cody. Cody's got some suggestions on my recommendations.
So we'll look for a new.
I'll send them out again if I do revise them.
Yes, and John sent me a document that is like the introductory part of it.
Okay.
So I'll send that around for review. All
right. Is John going to be back in the meeting for a minute?
No, John will be back.
I'll send it to you. I'm
pretty sure it's full spell.
Okay.
And you can get back to me on if you have questions. Or some of these are just questions.
So other comments from task force members for tonight?
I'm sorry.
Other comments for tonight from task force members? Okay. From staff or public? John?
Well, I'll try and go fast.
Okay.
Right here at the end, but it's not going to be just 2 minutes. But starting with this very ending thing, and I'm not sure who said, what you just learned was that zoning is not the same thing as the use of a building. Each utility over its defined, I think one of your major recommendations, because it's partly about funding, it's partly about that, one of your major recommendations should be that within a year, the utility somehow or another reached some kind of agreement so that across the major utilities, they're using the same definitions. What I've kind of heard, and of course Bill presented this little chart that showed, well, if you do the riser something with master meter versus other thing, there is a massive difference in revenue that comes to the city based on the base charges and so forth. And that turns out replicated across the city to be a huge horizontal equity problem in terms of who's paying for what. And really across all of your kind of things. So I would think that would be one of the major recommendations, and put a time limit on it. This has been, for various reasons, and some of them are good, but they should no longer be adequate. Our utilities have put off doing this for years. So that would be a great kind of thing. I was really glad to hear Cody and Tim Teddy talking about the idea of the value of the Boone County Northeast Transportation Plan, of which you have a CD. It turns out that it's too big to put on something. But there are a number of things that were really of value. I was really glad that you found this of value in terms of the predictability. And one of the things that should answer a number of their questions, if you read through it, even if it's just the executive summary, was they said, this is major streets. They said, actually, since this is relatively undeveloped, this approach would be changed if you were dealing with somewhat developed areas. But based on the projections, built out use that people have talked about, they were able to say, we're going to need this kind of arterial and connecting system. So they're able to get, but it's on that projected build-out basis. And then from that, they work back down. That's where they got their $7,000 per lot and $4,000 per lot. That's a really good model. And that's really exactly how different kind of thinking about development charges being internalized. Everybody was kind of worried about down the road. I would be, suppose it was a build-out for 30 years. The only problem I kind of see with that is that in 30 years, actually, that $7,000 per lot should probably be adjusted up based on some kind of inflation. That would tie it out to how much it's going to cost to build up some of the major roads down the road. And you don't have to be terribly minutely precise like 6 months, but you can address that kind of issue. So I really encourage you to include that somehow or another in the materials that you're looking at. I'm really glad that Tim brought all that up. You're getting into the transportation development charge, and you have some of the stuff from 10 years ago.
So we're at 3 minutes. Can you wrap up in a couple, please?
Not looking at one thing, looking at some kind of mixture of probably a property tax, supporting a general obligation bond for some of the, this is about arterial and connector collections, along with the sales tax, along with the square footage, but thinking, right now you have square footage and it's the footprint. So the rise has a footprint and then it's got 10 stories. Probably, in my opinion, needs to be adjusted for the square footage that's being used. But it's that multiple component of that kind of charge, because we're not in an impact fee state. So for these kind of things, that would be very important. And so the last thing, to some extent, I want to mention was, is to, I like a lot of the talk about how they're talking about sufficiency of resources. The council needs to define, in terms of level of service, and provide guidance to the staff for the meaning of that term adequate for the various kinds of things. And lastly, you mentioned and brought up, and we're asking the questions, Tracy, about, so what are we going to see? How are we going to know? For me, this means you are asking questions of Tim about all of the ex parte discussions that go on as soon as anybody's doing development, is talking to the staff, asking questions. Frankly, I think very on there, asking questions, and the staff is used over the here of saying, well, you know, you can't do that, but, you know, you got these other, I mean, actually helping them work their way through. But how to make those ex parte discussions more transparent, not just at the end as they go along. And so I would ask you to consider, as part of your global recommendations, asking the council to make it a very high priority to develop a set of guidelines for the staff to guide them in their ex parte discussions along the way, and then when different kind of things are going to be more public and more seen.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So I think that those things would really help.
Okay, great. All right.
Just to follow up real quick, I think they did take into account future dollars in that 2012 Northeast Transportation.
I'll go back and look at it. I mean, you're saying they projected out and pulled out, get a discount rate?
I think they did.
That would be useful to look at exactly how they do it. That whole idea of discounting future dollars, they were discounting that back to the present.
I don't know exactly the formula.
But that doesn't address, so if it's a 20-year build-out, the actual amount you'd be starting with is a base 15 years out, against which to take the credits, which, you know, I think you're exactly right. That's a really big part of that system.
Yes. Mr. Glasscock?
I think to get the bill support there, you don't have to change the metering. All you got to do is change how it's built.
Okay.
And all you need to do is charge a base charge for each unit, and whether you master meter or not. You don't have to change the building. You don't have to change anything. It's just the way you build it. And so if you're a residential unit, charge the base charge to it, whether it's master meter or not. You don't have to change your metering at all.
It's the definition.
So it has to be individual meter build. You just say an ordinance, we're going to charge a base charge every unit.
That would help that situation. But say if it's individual meter, it'd be more of an incentive to conserve water.
I understand, but then you're driving up the cost of the building astronomically to run copper all the way back to a header to every unit. And so, you know, if we're trying to get more revenue, which is what I think you're trying to do,
just change the building.
You're never going to do it in a master, in a
master
meter,
no, you're not.
Well, even a residential, if you're charging the same billing, they're using the same water. I'm just saying it's easy to do. You don't have to change a meter.
If the goal is increasing revenue.
We're here to try and figure out how to generate money.
And you don't have to address
the meter. Part of it is showing a monitor how much water it is. Right. Because it's base.
The EPA recommends annual meter.
It'd be hard to do a 10-story park.
All right.
Drive up the cost to you.
To reach those.
All right.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Reading the meters.
Okay. We're done. Anything else?
Reading the meters.
Okay.